The best thing about writing? Anything can happen. You get to build a world from scratch and fill it with daring heroes and epic tales of good and evil. The worst thing about writing? Anything can happen. Where do you even start when literally anything is possible? How about a deck with more than 30 billion writing or world-building prompts? The Story Engine deck and Deck of Worlds are a great way to fire up your imagination. Create a new character with fun quirks and daring motivations in less than 60 seconds with the Story Engine. With Deck of Worlds, build entire civilizations with distinct foods, customs, and history, and set the plot in motion with world-shaking conflicts for your characters to overcome. It's time to write your next bestseller. Our decks give you the tools to tell the story you want to tell. Visit StoryEngineDeck.com and use promo code AboutWriting10 at checkout to get 10% off your entire order from now until September 30th. That's AboutWriting10. Slay your writer's block and get excited to sit down at your desk every day. Go to StoryEngineDeck.com and pick up the Story Engine Deck and Deck of Worlds.
Hi there and welcome to our show, The Shit No One Tells You About Writing. I'm Bianca Murray, and I'm joined by Carly Waters and Cece Lira from PS Literary Agency. We'll be kicking off today's episode with our usual Books with Hooks segment, after which we'll go to today's guest.
We'll be taking a break from recording new Books with Hooks segments over the summer so that we can recharge our batteries and return fully energized in the fall. We'll still be critiquing two new Books with Hooks submissions each week, though, which our paid Substack subscribers will get every Tuesday through our newsletter. That's until we return with new segments to air in the fall. So continue to submit your queries to us through our website. In the meantime, we'll be kicking it back by playing Books with Hooks episodes from our backlist while still airing brand new author interviews each week.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to another episode. As usual, we're going to begin with our Books with Hooks segment, which I am now going to belly flop straight into. Carly, would you like to begin with our first query letter?
Absolutely. Hello, Bianca, Carly, and Cecilia. I love the podcast, and I'm excited by the opportunity to have my query letter considered for inclusion in your Books with Hooks segment. I'll soon be seeking representation for my 70,000-word YA novel, The Ghosts and Our Reflections, so your feedback would be greatly appreciated. My manuscript is a dual POV paranormal novel that might interest fans of Amy Talkington's Live Forever, Meg Cruz, Giving Up the Ghost, or Laura Whitcomb's A Certain Slant of Light. For 16-year-old Isla Rimini, the appeal of moving to the Northern Indiana intentional community isn't its claim to be a sanctuary for those seeking human connection in the digital age. She doesn't care about the communal dinners or restrictions on technology. What sells Isla on the property is its history, built 100 years ago as a wellness center by an eccentric billionaire, then transformed into an artist retreat where legendary painters visited. Isla is a painter herself, after all, and living in a space once occupied by master artists can only improve her work. Besides, she and her father are still in the house where her mother succumbed to cancer, so a move might do them good. For 17-year-old Milo Selby, life in his hometown has become unbearable. After a year of tragedies, a life-changing car accident, becoming the ward of his volatile older brother, Milo is expelled from school and branded a bully because a comment he posted on his YouTube art channel was later associated with the suicide of a fellow student. He's fine with his brother's idea of moving to a strange tech-phobic community because all he wants is to get off the grid. When they meet, it's not lost on Isla or Milo how unlikely it is that this small community would accept two families with art-obsessed teenagers, each grieving the loss of parents. Both assume, though, it has something to do with the ghosts that haunt the property. When Isla first sees the lovely spectral woman wearing a men's dress shirt and tie, she mistakes her for a muse. After all, she's never painted as well as when the woman stands by her watching. Isla doesn't come to suspect the spirit's true nefarious nature until the woman takes possession of Milo's body, feeding off his pain and anger and twisting him to her will. Now separated physically and technologically from the world, Isla must identify the ghost and uncover the secret history of the property to save the lives of Milo herself and all the community's residents. My short fiction has appeared in New World Writing, Bull, Spectrum Literary Journal, Abstract Magazine, Litro Online, and Everyday Fiction, among other publications. I'm a winner of the Say Goodnight to Illiteracy competition. I hold an MFA in creative writing. Thank you for your time. Best wishes, M.
Carly, thank you so much. Cece, why don't you tell us what you think of the query letter?
So there's so much to love here, right? Like a ghost story, confined space, people of different backgrounds coming together. I love all that. I feel like those are all great ingredients for a story. In terms of the query letter, in terms of like giving feedback, in the first paragraph, dual POV is written D-U-E-L. And I didn't know if that was intentional. Like maybe they have a duel going on and that would be kind of cool. But I would also not recommend doing that because we might assume, like an agent might assume it's a typo, right? So unless, or I, if it is intentional, like specify that or just write it regular D-U-A-L. One thing that, one note that I did have, like this is YA, I don't rep YA, but I appreciate YA and Isla seems like an adult. Like if you remove her age from this query letter, everything that's said about her, not about Milo, but about her is sounds like an adult problem. There isn't a single thing that's specific to a 16-year-old. She sounds so mature. It's, you know, with the painting and the muse and it, I don't know. I felt like it wasn't YA, but maybe this is just me being biased because I read a lot of adult fiction. With Milo, it was a little different. Like he got expelled from school. He got branded a bully. You know, there was a social media thing going on. Like those things read to me as being a little bit more kid-like, really. I appreciate that the author in the last plot paragraph made it clear what's at stake and what the climax was, right? Like the sentence that starts with, Isla doesn't come to suspect the spirit's true nefarious nature. Like that sentence from there on, we know what the climax is. We know what's at stake. And that's really, really good. I would have wanted a bit more specificity because specificity is key. So this doesn't sound like a generic ghost story, but honestly, very, very good. Like if I had to give the author notes, these are my notes, but I would be curious. I also really enjoyed the last paragraph. Carly, what do you think?
All right. I also had that note about the dual versus dual, like D-U-E-L. I thought I had a note like, is that intentional? But I agree with you, right? Like if we are stopping and questioning and stumbling, it's an issue. So either way, I would turn it back to dual with an A.
Can I hop in there with the misunderstanding we had during my multi POV and dual timelines class? Because of the way I pronounce things, about 10 minutes or 20 minutes into the class, somebody wrote on the chat, what is a dual POV, J-E-W-E-L, because they thought that's what I was talking about.
Dual, yeah.
Dual POV. So we were like, well, that's a multifaceted POV. Okay, carry on, Carly.
Oh gosh, that's so funny. That's my favorite part about this podcast. We all like have our little quirks and idiosyncrasies with our dialects. I think this first paragraph needed a hook about how they come together. Because my big thing with dual and dual POV is that I want to know, like, why are we reading about these people, right? And what makes this a book and not two short stories or two novellas or whatnot, right? So I also thought the paranormal bit was buried, right? Like we don't really actually get to the paranormal until the bottom. So I think we need a hook about how they come together in this paranormal world at the top before we break out into the two separate description scenes. I definitely was confused about Isla's parental situation because it's just very confusing as to, like, it almost seems like she's moving herself to Indiana, you know, as Cece was saying, right? Like, is she an adult? Is she a teen? Like, we don't actually know. So I was just confused about that. And that also will lead into some of my notes for the pages later, but I'll get to that later. And then for Milo, like what a complicated and interesting situation. I mean, talk about, you know, tension and drama and just this whole conflict with technology and teens. Like, I just think there's a lot of really interesting stuff going on there. And then this third paragraph is again, trying to bring everybody together, but like, I'm a bit confused. Like, I think we need to cut the first line of the paragraph because it says when they meet, it's not lost on Isla or Milo, how unlikely it is that this small community would accept two families with art-obsessed teenagers, each grieving the loss of parents. We know this, right? Like you just told us that in each of the paragraphs that they both are going through this situation. So I don't know who that line is for. So I would just cut all of that. And really, yes, we're bearing the paranormal here. So that's where I think we just need to kind of like, we could maybe even condense this paragraph by half, probably by taking out the hook, popping it at the top and just like cutting all the stuff that we already know. Anything that's a duplicate, just like strike through, right? We don't want any repetition because you're already repeating two teens' POVs in a query letter. So there is already a lot of duplicates. But all of that to say, it is very, very interesting. You know, I love the paranormal hook. I think that paranormal is coming back. I will say that. I think that we've had enough time and separation. I know agents got really burnt out on paranormal. The industry did as well, but I've heard, you know, witches are back. Ghosts really never went away. Like ghosts are back. And I've heard vampires might be coming back too. So there you go. Word on the street.
Yeah, because Colleen Hoover did Layla. I think that came out last year and that did phenomenally well again. So yeah. Okay, Cece, what were your thoughts on the opening pages?
All right, let's do this. So there were a lot of details that I liked. So for example, right on page one, we're in Isla's POV and she's watching these birds and she's remembering her mom. And she's saying that her mom has passed away and she called them our fat squatters. There's these small details that I really, really like. The one thing that kept tripping me though, is that she seems like an adult. Everything about her voice, the fact that she would refer to the hospice counselor as the hospice counselor and not as Ms. whoever, or give us a sharp visual or something, like that's typically how teens remember people. The fact that she mentions that her summer break was blessedly here, and that just sounds like someone who wants to establish. I wanted to know specifically why. Like, I get that her mom is sick, right? Like, I didn't even do a roundup for the listener. For the listener, Isla is, you know, she knows her mom haunts her, even if it's just in her head. She keeps seeing signs of her mom. Her dad calls her and she's painting. Her dad calls her and he tells her that they're moving to this community. He tells her about this community, right? Like, and she asks all these questions and obviously they're going to move there. We know this because of the query letter, but this is not a teenage girl. It's lines like, I would have considered it beneath me to copy someone else's work. Even her dialogue with her dad, like she was asking a lot of questions, but there was very little emotion. And teenage girls are all about emotion. It's all we feel. It's like it's a pressure cooker situation of hormones. I remember being one very, very well. And it just wasn't there for me. I thought that the dialogue could be compressed. It was too long. I wanted more internal life. I got very little internal life from her. This is also where the emotion comes in. And it's all very dad-centric. Like, I know more about the dad than I know about the mom or Isla. Like, that he was a savant, a legit genius app developer with poor social skills, hopeless at conversation. I don't know. Maybe she's not the protagonist in the story. I would also urge the author to take a look at the writing on a line level. So, for example, on page 5, it wasn't strictly true that we didn't have people around us. We technically had granddad. Further along that same paragraph, we get didn't exactly get along. Like, it's a lot of adverbs that are doing the same thing. You don't need all that. You can cut back. It just gets distracting after a while. So again, I don't think her voice is a teenager's voice. I think her dialogue needs more internal life and more emotion. And it's your book, but I would have rather Isla know about the place before, right? Like, I would have preferred it to be this dream she had. She was obsessed with it because all the painters went there. She had posters on her bedroom or something. But there was this obstacle. It can't just be the mom. Okay, it has to be something else, like her dad's job or something. That, like, they would never go there. And then her dad finally does this thing for her, right? And she's like, wait, what? Are you serious? Like, I feel like that would have made it a stronger scene. Yeah, those are my notes. Carly, what do you think?
Yeah, I'm just nodding along. I think making this more teen-centric is really important. And I think you're hitting on some interesting things because teens' worlds revolve around them, right? Like, adults are just like moons to their planet, right? Like, they are the world. So really, I mean, centering on the dad figure here and the more adult language, I think really detracts from that like teen energy. And another thing I think that I wanted to talk about is, I think everybody, you know, listening to this in terms of writers have heard this before, but like what a quiet novel is and what feels quiet and what feels loud and what is the opposite of quiet and that kind of thing. So this is coming off extremely quiet because it's coming off very passive. We're not talking about, you know, any big decisions or big tense moments. We're having a teen and a dad having a very casual, easy conversation. It's not like there's a time crunch. It's not like there's an energy here. It's like, oh, okay, my dad called me twice. But and even, you know, the dad said like, Isla, like there's no, you know, he said angrily or he said tersely or anything. It's just like, what is the tone of this interaction? I'm just not really feeling an energy here. And I know that this is going to be a dramatic book. And that's what worries me about this, because we're not starting in a place that is coming to us with a lot of energy. And we don't have to start with a paranormal. We don't have to start with a prologue. That's not what I'm asking. I'm saying, where is the energy? Where is the vibe that this book is trying to project, especially when it's supposed to be spooky or you're pitching this in some sort of, you know, kind of like gothic way? We really need that energy and that creepiness to kind of come at us, even if it's not on the nose, right? There don't have to be boogeymen in the closet, but there has to be an energy. And I'm worried that this is coming off quiet for me. And that's kind of my biggest concern, because I don't think it's necessarily a quiet book. I think we're starting in the wrong place. Maybe we should start with Milo, because it seems like Milo maybe has a lot more drama like happening in the moment. we don't need a history of the property, right? That's not something that we need at this point. We need to figure out all of that later. What we need to know is, how are we going to get to this property as quickly as possible? Because the drama doesn't happen at home. The drama happens on the property. So I'm just asking for, you know, a little bit more energy and maybe just thinking about whether we're starting in the right place.
Thanks. And just my two cents as a creative writing instructor is that if you are struggling very much with a character's voice in the first person, which is especially true of trying to capture a teenage voice, it might be easier for you to write her in the third person so that you as the author become the narrator. And so it's fine for most of that to be in your narrative voice, but then you really have to nail her dialogue, which is obviously much easier to nail than nailing the entire narrative. And then, you know, get into her head with the emotions and stuff more, but that might be easier for you to do. All right. So Cece, would you like to read the next query letter for us?
Let's do this. Dear Ms. Lyra and Ms. Waters, shaving your legs for the first time is a rite of passage for most girls, but it could kill 12-year-old Sophie Flaherty. Or so it seems to her mother, Deirdre, who sees the bloody nicks on her daughter's legs, hears the words, Daddy's razor, and fears the disease taking her husband's life, the disease they don't talk about, will destroy Sophie as well. In a time which funeral homes refuse to embalm victims of the AIDS pandemic, Deirdre and Edward consider their decision to claim he's dying from cancer, not AIDS, to be an act of love. But that doesn't mean it won't haunt them and Sophie for the rest of their lives. Complete at just over 78,000 words, X is a literary fiction novel that likely has crossover appeal for book club readers. It traces the impact of Deirdre and Edward's lie on its tellers, as well as on Sophie, whose adult life retracts into a series of compulsions meant to protect her from being the next widow. Interwoven with the story of Edward's own father's suspicious death and his mother Lynette's role in it, the novel follows the Flaherty family's struggle for redemption, despite generations of refusing to recognize the pain their intolerances, self-dramatizing imaginations, and obsession with appearances have on each other. Like Atonement by Ian McEwan, X is told from different perspectives, spans 6+ decades, and demonstrates the devastating impact that our actions, and sometimes more importantly, our inactions, can have on others. As a trigger warning, X include instances of historical homophobia and stigma against people with HIV/AIDS and depicts a character who self-harms. I've published nonfiction works, including a co-author chapter on the legal rights of people living with HIV/AIDS. X has benefited from my participation in a masterclass led by Christine Desmet at the University of Wisconsin-Madison's Right by the Lake Seminar, the mentorship of Angela Rydell through the same institution's Pathway to Publication program, and my attendance at numerous writing conferences, including the Writers Hotel 2020. I am currently participating in a private study program with the Writers Hotel co-founders, Scott Wolven and Shanna McNair, and I'm actively working on my second novel. I would love to discuss representation with you. Thank you so much for your consideration. Sincerely, Name.
Thanks, Cece. Carly, what did you think?
Well, I had some mixed feelings about the structure. That first paragraph, like, wow, that really like punched me in the gut in terms of like really being in scene in a queer. We don't really see that too often starting like that. And this is a very dramatic, you know, moment with, you know, the razor in the blood and kind of explaining the kind of stigmatization. So I think I would normally never, ever, ever suggest anybody starting in scene in a query like this, but it really did grab me. The only issue I have with this structure is that it makes it seem like Sophie is the main character. And then I get to the next paragraph and I'm like, oh, Sophie's not the main character. Like that made me like recheck everything that I just thought. So so this is why I have mixed feelings, because it does the job of really grabbing me, which a query is supposed to do, but it really confused me about who's the main character. So maybe this isn't the best start. One thing I found that we were missing from this was comps that were much more kind of in line with what was happening thematically with the book, because Atonement is a good comp, I think, for this book. It's an exceptional, exceptional work of art. I mean, it's a phenomenal novel. I do think it could be a good comp here, but we're missing comps about the AIDS crisis, right? And so two I wanted to point out, two happen to be my favorite books of all time. So I would highly recommend everybody read them as well as comp them. But The Great Believers by Rebecca Mackay and Tell the Wolves I'm Home. Both of those are just phenomenal books and I think would really be great comps for this. So I would, if you haven't, if this author hasn't read them, obviously read them before you comp them in your book, but I would recommend them. So here in this middle paragraph, I'm getting confused. And I think this echoes a lot of what we said last week on the podcast when we talk about intergenerational issues and being vague about intergenerational trauma. Because again, I am super interested in intergenerational books. So I would request this, like, obviously this is like exactly what I would want to read. And as you can tell, I'm swept up in it, but I have no idea what's going on. I don't know who the main character is. I don't know what this redemption is about. I don't really know anything that's going on. I would request it, but I have no idea what's going on. We have, it's told from different perspectives, spans 6 decades, demonstrates the devastating impact of our actions. Like everything about this is totally up my alley, but I don't know what's going on. So I think I would just want to know a little bit more pointedly what is happening in the present, right? A lot of this intergenerational trauma stuff is great. And we're going to cover some decades. Great. But what's going on in the present? I do like sweeping novels, but we have to be about what's happening in the moment. But yeah, I mean, you hooked me. You did a great job.
Thanks, Carly. Cece, what were your thoughts on that?
I echo Carly's words. I was also really grabbed by the first paragraph. I was like, oh my gosh, because that is a powerful opener. But then when I understood, or at least I think I understood correctly, that this is not going to be told from Sophie's POV. This is not Sophie's story. She's not the main protagonist, I guess. Then I was like, wait, hold on. And so I am against this first paragraph. Here's why. Yes, it hooked like two agents, right? Like two out of two. But it also frustrated me. Speaking just for myself. So I don't think that you want to frustrate someone. I think that you should start with, you know, maybe write. Here's like my tip for you. And this is going to be super easy, she said sarcastically. Write a paragraph that's just as grabby, but not about Sophie. So that's your job, writer. Do that. I love intergenerational stories. I think it's so interesting. There's so much potential there. You know, I just finished Haven Point and it has nothing to do with the AIDS crisis, but it has everything to do with like how intergenerational trauma plays a role in our present, right? Ask Again, Yes. These are all books that I love. I do think though, like books that talk about like we repeat what we don't repair. I do think though that we need more specificity. So yes to everything that Carly said. I very much agree.
Thanks, Cece. Okay, Carly, would you give us a bit of an understanding of what's in those opening pages and then your thoughts on it?
Yeah, so we have chapter one and chapter two. So they're both quite short. So chapter one, we're figuring out this is the mother character. We're in 1989. There's a timestamp. Great. The mother is kind of watching her son pass of AIDS. And then quickly, we're jumping to chapter two. Both of these are only a couple pages long. We're getting to Edward in 1986. So we're going back into the past here. This is the man who's dying of AIDS. We're going back. And it starts with a consensual gay sex scene, basically. So those are kind of our two entry points into this novel. So I didn't like opening with Lynette, and I will tell you why. This really kind of, even though it's called chapter one, to me, it feels like a prologue because we do not have the context for why we're seeing the scene we're seeing, right? Unfortunately, nothing here is new in terms of perception, in terms of pop culture and books of, again, unfortunately, watching a man pass of AIDS, right? I don't feel like I'm learning anything new in this scene. And so what I would want to know is what is special about this scene and in terms of this context, in terms of relationship this mother and son have, because that's what's interesting to me. And I don't have any context because I don't know about the relationship. Are these two even close? I get the sense of this line. It says, he didn't deserve this no matter what he said he was, right? There's a lot of misconception about, you know, AIDS and the stigma and everything like that, right? And being gay and all of that, right? So I don't know anything about the relationship between these two people. I wanted to cry. Like, this is a devastating scene. A mother should not watch a child pass, right? That's against, you know, the quote unquote laws of nature. And I wanted to feel a huge range of emotion. I wanted to be gutted. I wanted to cry. You know, I wanted to feel some feelings. And unfortunately, I didn't feel anything. It's a beautifully written chapter, but I'm not feeling anything because I don't know these people yet. In order for me to feel attached to these people, I kind of need to know why we are feeling this. So I think we need a new opening. That said, I don't think chapter two is the opening, which is why I think that this author opened with chapter one. Chapter two is Edward coming in from the suburbs into New York City to have what possibly might be his first gay sex experience. It's consensual and everything like that. It's just like, in terms of a scene, in terms of opening a novel with it, it's just a lot, you know, it's a lot to handle. So I would say this probably isn't the opening either. those are kind of my main notes. I mean, the actual like sexual interaction is extremely well written. Extremely well written. You know, there's this line, a couple lines here. One of the lines I really liked was there's going to be a financial transaction for the sex act. And the man paying for the sex says, "Thank God he had the smaller bill. Asking for change would have been more than he could handle." Like, holy shit. That is just like, makes you smile, makes you be like, oh my God, like so human, right? To be like, I'm paying for sex for the first time with a man. And do I ask for change? Like, wow. That is just knocked my socks off. In terms of the tension, right? He's like, so the man who is offering the sex says, the man pushed Edward inside and closed the door. $10 for a hand job, 30 for head, 50 for anal. The man smiles. And it just felt like so much tension in this moment of him having to decide, like, it's really a coming of age story of a gay man. And in terms of like, you know, putting himself in this situation and coming of age in this way. So I really felt like that scene was wonderfully written. I just don't think it's the opening of a novel. So those are my notes. I mean, really extremely talented author here.
Can I ask a question before we move on to Cece? It's a recurring question. So Rebecca Mackay got a lot of acclaim for The Great Believers, but then there was also a lot of criticism that this book was written about gay men from a straight woman's perspective. Same happened with Tanya Yangira's A Little Life. So what are your thoughts on this, you know, in terms of women writing from a gay man's perspective?
I think it's an excellent question and one that will always come across my mind just as it did for you, right? I always think about, you know, who has the right to tell the story? You know, how should a story be written? Is it done sensitively and tastefully and authentically? And has it had sensitivity readers, right? Like these would be the types of conversations I'd be having with somebody. I always come back to, and I've talked about this before on the podcast, was Alexander Chee's essay in Vulture, and he asks three questions. So the article is called How to Unlearn Everything. When it comes to writing the quote unquote other, what questions are we not asking? And the first question is, why do you want to write from this character's point of view? The next question is, do you read writers from this community currently? And the third question is, why do you want to tell this story? And there's a lot more context to the article, and I highly recommend everybody read it. It's from 2019, but I have it bookmarked and I send it to people all the time because to me, it really, it uncovers and tackles a lot of the politics and the identity politics of who gets to write what and how. I do believe that talented writers can write the quote unquote other. I do believe that, right? Authors who have immense talent and are very empathic people and can do it sensitively in a very talented way can do it. I do believe that, but not without criticism, right? Not without the questioning. And all of those questions are valid, but it doesn't take away from how great the book is and if talented writers can write.
Thank you. Right. Cece, what did you think of it?
I echo Carly's notes on like, we're not starting in the right place. So when I, first of all, thank you for the timestamp. I know Carly has already thanked you, but thank you for me too. Timestamps are wonderful. Every writer out there, please just use timestamps. When I saw Lynette's chapter, I was like, yes, like I get how this is emotional. It's a mom losing her son. Like who wouldn't relate to this? But it doesn't make me feel curious. And even though I suspect the author wanted us to feel curious with certain lines like, for example, Lynette is speaking, I whispered to you just like I'm whispering now. I said, my son, you will not become your father. It hadn't been the vow he needed for her to make, though she couldn't have known it. There are seeds that are being planted, questions that we're meant to ask, to be asking, and theories that we're probably meant to be forming, but it's not a good starting point. Keep this chapter. I'm not saying you won't use it, but I don't think it's the entry point into this building. And then with Edward's chapter, I also highlighted the tip, not the tip, sorry, because I had a question, like, wouldn't you tip him? Like, is tip not expected? Like, I have all sorts of questions, right? But the question about change, I was like, oh my gosh, I totally get that. How it'd be so anxiety inducing to ask for change. Like, who would do that? There were so many great details, right? Like details about his leather wallet, like, and the fact that, you know, his daughters had given him the wallet last Father's Day and he ignores their faces. Obviously the faces from the pictures, right? Like when you open someone's wallet, especially back then, you usually had pictures. So I really loved the scene. It's very well written. I still don't think it's the right place to start. Oh, and I have a question about the financial transaction, because the man asks, top or bottom, wouldn't that change the price? Like, just saying, like, I think that would change the price. So I don't know, but I my instincts tell me it would. So that was my very specific transactional question. But I still don't think we're starting in the right place. And this is a personal view. So this is a CC view. Do not make any changes unless you agree. But I'm against starting stories with surrender. And that's what this is. He is surrendering to desire. He's surrendering to a craving that he's kept bottled up for so long. It's taboo because of the age that we are in, right? This is the late 80s. It's sexy. It's filled with craving and desire and longing and passion. And these are interesting things. I don't think they're opening scene material, because surrender isn't curiosity inducing from the story forward perspective, right? Like, I finished reading the scene and I finished reading a great short story. I'm not going, oh my God, what's going to happen next, right? Like, you want an opening scene that has buildup, an opening scene that has tension, that creates stress and strain, not an opening scene where there's surrender. So for example, and this is not what the story is, but if at the end of this great scene, there had been a knock on the door and his wife were there, that would have made me wonder what the heck was going to happen next. Or if he left the bathroom stall and he ran into his boss, right? And there had been a mention or two woven in inner life that his boss was super conservative. I don't know. Again, this is not what this book is. I'm not suggesting doing any of these things, but I'm telling you things that would have made me go, oh my God, what's going to happen next? So if you want to start with surrender, add something, a seg that's going to make me go, oh gosh, I wonder what will happen in chapter two. That is very important in a novel. A novel is not a short story. You're not supposed to make me feel completely satisfied by the end of chapter one. And this is how I felt when I read this. I was like, that was a great story.
The other thing I wanted to add to that was about the consequences, right? Because this kind of goes back to my earlier notes about we're not learning anything new, right? You're not adding to our understanding. A lot of this is things that we have gleaned from pop culture or family stories or friend stories at the time, right? So we're not like the consequences are, does he get AIDS from this transaction? As opposed to, I left my wife's work Christmas party early to come here because we were already in the city, right? Or like that like what are the repercussions for his marriage, his job? Like, these are the things that CC's getting at, right? Like, what are the consequences of this? That's the kind of stuff that we haven't got.
Wonderful. Thank you. Right. We'll now go into our third query letter, which I will read. Dear Colly and Cecilia, Warm Blood at 72,000 words is a historical fantasy with feminist undercurrents. Set in Victorian London, this tale of family, revenge, social expectations, and embittered vampires will appeal to readers of magical realism in the style of Caroline Lee, The Glass Woman, Sarah Penner, The Lost Apothecary, and Sarah Perry Melmoth. Spinster in the making, Grace Sadler will carry her crime to the grave. When her estranged father dies on the eve of his return, Grace's frugal existence on the Cornish coast comes to an abrupt end. Now, living in London with her overbearing aunt, Grace turns her plight into an opportunity and rekindles her artistic ambitions. Martin Sadler dreams of adventures in the new world. When his recklessness ruins his sister's prospects, Martin plans a new fail-proof, get-rich-quick scheme. He will sell the long-lost verses of the infamous romantic Pietro Gentilecci to the highest bidder. There's only one problem. The poems are buried with Gentilecci's erstwhile muse, Arcangela Rossini. Undeterred by trivial details, Martin enlists the help of his trusted friends, George and Edward, only to disappear the night of the robbery. United by their common goal to find out what happened to Martin, Grace and George gravitate towards each other. Only that George knows more than he lets on, Grace's secret threatens to slip out, and none of them pay heed to the son-averse gentleman who's pulling everyone's strings. I'm a bookstore manager from Romania. Together with my partner, our daughter, and two nefarious felines, I live a stone's throw away from Dracula's fake castle in the heart of Transylvania. Thanks for your consideration, Jules. Jules, there's just one thing I want to say before I hand across to Colly and Cece, is that as soon as I read Grace Sadler, I thought of Grace Adler from Will and Grace, and then pictured her as this throughout. So maybe tweak those last names there a bit. Okay. Cece, would you like to begin with your thoughts on the query letter?
Grace Adler, I love it. Okay. Someone on Twitter, and I wish I could remember who, it's one of our loyal followers, said that we should have a drinking game where every time someone says, I'm confused, someone takes a sip. Well, get your coffees or your cocktails or your mocktails or whatever you're drinking, because I was confused. Okay, so I don't understand the first two sentences of the first plot paragraph, like spinster in the making, Grace Sadler, and then when her estranged father. I don't get how they're connected. Like, I have no idea. I also don't get how old Grace is, and her age matters. It makes all the difference, right? Like, I understand that age meant something different back in whenever, because I also don't know when we are. So I was confused about that too. And we're mentioning like the Americas as the new world. So I can take a guess, but still it's like a century gap guess. So I also did not know that Martin was her brother until I read the pages. This is not clear. I understand that in Martin's paragraph, there's a mention of his sister and they share the same last name. But that's a stretch. Remember, you're dealing with over-caffeinated agents who read 50 queries at a time. Don't do this to us. You know, be nice to our brains. Like on the third plot paragraph, the one that starts with united by their common goal, I was like, so what about like Grace and George gravitate towards each other? I'm like, what about Edward? Is Edward just standing there? Like, I don't, like, is he not essential? Like, is this story about Grace and George? Like, if so, then why all the real estate on Martin? And then when we got to the last sentence, like no one is paying heed to the son of verse gentleman. I'm like, oh yeah, vampires. In the first paragraph, they promised me vampires. I forgot about the vampires. So I was very confused. Very, very confused. I love the nefarious feline comment. Love cats. I am not a dog person or a cat person. I'm an animal person. So, you know, talk to me about all your furry babies. But this, to me, I don't understand what's going on. And I have lovely things to say about the pages. So you are not doing yourself any favors with this query letter, because your pages are much, much better.
Holly, how many shots have you had in being confused?
Oh, man, I don't know if we have enough time for that. I think we need to make sure we drop the episode at, like, I don't know, happy hour Eastern time or something like that, so we can get our shots in. I wanted to love that. Like, I wanted to love this query, right? Like, there, as Cece said, there is so much that's happening here. It's really interesting. I just couldn't fall head over heels for some of the reasons that Cece had mentioned, right? So how many POVs is this? At what year in Victorian London are we in? What is the crime? Are they rich? Are they poor? Classism has a lot to do with things here. And I just don't think we're tackling the classism. One of the things I'm confused in regarding the money is that it says, Grace's frugal existence. And then it says on the Cornish coast comes to an abrupt end. Is it the frugal existence that comes to an end, or is it the Cornish coast that comes to an end? Because I almost thought it was both. I was like, oh, did she fall into money now? That was kind of what I was confused about. So I think we need to really address the classism head on in terms of their social standing, because it matters a lot in Victorian time periods. Grace's paragraph reads a lot like synopsis, so I would try and just like massage that a little bit so it doesn't kind of read so staccato. Martin's section, I had a note saying like, what does this have to do with Grace, right? Because like, how are these two people interacting? My big thing about multiple POVs and multiple characters is what brings them together, right? So, and at the bottom, it says united by their common goal to find out what happened to Martin, right? And you're burying that common goal. So I want to know at the top with the hook, what is bringing them all together? I'm assuming, again, making assumptions here, that she killed her dad or had something to do with the death of her father. That's my guess, my clue. But all of that is very interesting, but I just don't think this query is doing itself justice, right? So we are being harsh on you because we know this is better. We know this is better than it's leading on to be. And we really just want you to find success with this, because as we said, the pages are great. So hopefully you can take these notes and rework it, because we see tons and tons of promise here.
Thanks, Carly. Cece, what were your thoughts on the actual pages? Can you give us a bit of an overview of what happens?
Yes. So we are at a funeral. This is told from Grace's point of view. The first two lines are great. It's Grace promised herself she wouldn't cry. Some people didn't deserve tears. It's the funeral of her father. We know based on inner life that her brother is there and that he's sad. And she assumes that he is sad because he is grieving the father he'd only met for the first time a week ago. So that was very interesting. We see a man sitting at a bench at a distance, and Grace is worried that he is the police coming for her because she has obviously done something wrong and she's concerned that someone has found out about it. We don't know what that something is. And at the end, there's a figure called Aunt Lydia, which totally made me think of Handmaid's Tale. But Aunt Lydia tells Grace, you were lucky because you had witnesses. Otherwise, there would have been an inquest. Your father died on the eve of his return. So that's quite the coincidence, right? So that's just an overview of what happens. I always say that grief is not an active emotion. It does not make me feel curious. I do not recommend starting with grief. Well, this writer has just proved me wrong. This is great. I am very curious. This is an active emotion situation funeral because it's not your run-of-the-mill grief, right? Like she's not just there feeling sad for her father. She's actually concerned the police is after her, which is just cool, right? Like I want characters like this. I want protagonists like this. It's very intriguing. Panic knotted her innards. 3 years later, had someone finally puzzled her out? But how or who? Like very interesting. The man apparently looks like an escaped madman and he's carrying an umbrella even though it's not raining. So, you know, this is interesting, interesting stuff. There's also a lot of emotion. So, for example, her brother is standing between his friends, Edward and George, like a street urchin caught between an uppity sergeant and the well-meaning constable. This is just great writing, great stuff, right? Like the writer, I'm telling you, you did not do yourself any favors with that query letter. I had questions. And so one of the questions I had, perhaps what Martin grieved was not the death of a father he'd only met for the first time a week ago, but the death of hope. A, beautiful sentence. B, you said he'd only met a week ago. Does that mean that you, Grace, not you, the author, had met him before, the father? If not, make it they'd only met, right? If so, keep it this way. And I'm just super curious and I love it. I love that she doesn't want to cry. I love that the priest is being kind of, you know, kind of invasive and she's sort of like trying to dodge his questions. I love what he said about men make mistakes, Miss Grace. I kept thinking to myself, yep, men can, women can't, right? Like, especially back then. I had one question, which is probably just me getting confused by the English language, but I'm just going to say it. You say the eve of his return. To me, that makes me think of the day before, but that can't be it. I'm assuming you mean eve like evening. Maybe that's how people used eve back then. I don't know, but I don't get it. Like her father can't have died on the eve of his return, meaning the day before the return, because he has returned. So I would clarify that because I think people think of eve like Christmas Eve, like the day before. So I think it sounds confusing. Also, the penultimate paragraph, the one that starts with, she looked at Martin who kept his head down. Aunt Lydia is talking, I think. And I watched Downton Abbey. So this is my expert opinion on someone who I think would say, I don't think she would say you must go to London for the best medical care. I think she would say one must go to London for the best medical care. That is 100% how people on Downton Abbey talk. So I think that, you know, this makes me an expert and I should be able to give you advice based on that. So yeah, this is a great, great job. I'm curious. I would have kept on reading. You did a wonderful, wonderful job.
Carly, what were your thoughts?
Yeah, one of my main notes is actually what Cece was just talking about, is that I don't think we nailed the Victorian voice here. And because this writer is so talented, I'm almost wondering if this is intentional and we're going to be doing some time slipping back and forth because this felt very modern. Another example is that the main character, Grace, says police inspectors. Like, would they really have called people police inspectors in Victorian England? Like, I don't think they would. There's just little things like that in terms of the dialogue, again, feeling modern, that I'm very unsure that we're actually in Victorian time period. So I do think we need the timestamp. And if I'm reading too much into this and, you know, we're not doing time slipping or anything like that, meaning like time travel back and forth, I really think the author needs to kind of really dig deep and make sure that like we're really hitting every beat in terms of research about Victorian time periods, because people who read historical fiction will be absolute sharks on you about this type of stuff, right? So we also have to be sharks on you at this stage. So really everything from dialogue to are they called police, right? Like research, binging Downton Abbey, if that's what it takes, right? It's research. So really just, I'm not convinced we're in Victorian times. All that to say, I am fascinated by this sneaky Grace and her mishaps and her crimes and her, you know, I don't know. I think she's sneaky, and I like sneaky women in Victorian time period because it suggests, as you said in your pitch, that this has feminist undercurrents. I'm seeing this, right? I'm seeing this woman going against the grain here. My main concern is really just, are we actually portraying the time period as it should be? You know, a line that I highlighted that I really liked was at the funeral, under a leafless oak tree, right? Somebody could have said, oh, it's fall, late fall, it's almost winter, or the snow is falling, but they said under a leafless oak tree, right? That says so much in such few words, right? So I know we're working with a talented author here. I know there's immense talent here. So I just kind of want to help you bring this to the next level, because I think this is very, very interesting. Bring on the vampires.
Thank you. And a tip there is to just, when you're writing this kind of time period and you're going for this kind of voice, immerse yourself in reading those kinds of books. Listen to those stories that are told in, you know, audiobooks that are done that way. It really becomes a hugely immersive experience, so that the voice comes to you so much more naturally without the modern day voice slipping in there as well. All right. Thanks, Carly and Cece. Right. Let's go to today's guest.
After spending our summer vacation this year in Europe, it opened my eyes and my kids' eyes to the power of language and finding common ground no matter who we are and where we are. One of the most important things to me as a parent of two is making sure my kids see other places in the world and are exposed to the languages they speak around the globe. They're in French immersion education, and I'm honestly already getting left behind. I took French class in school until grade 9, and I have a big gap in my learning that I'm ready to fill. And that's why I rely on Rosetta Stone, the most trusted language learning program available on desktop or as an app, and it truly immerses you in the languages that you want to learn. I know my kids' language learning skills are going to explode past me, and I'm ready to catch them, and that's why we have Rosetta Stone. It's a trusted expert for 30 years with millions of users and 25 languages offered. We're talking Spanish, French, Italian, German, Korean, Chinese, Japanese, Dutch, Arabic, Polish, and many, many more. There is fast language acquisition. Rosetta Stone immerses you in many ways. There are no English translations, so you really learn to speak, listen, and think in that language. There's an intuitive process. You're picking up a language naturally. First with words, and then with phrases, and then sentences. And it is designed for long-term retention. There is speech recognition technology. It is called True Accent. It is built in. It's a feature that gives you feedback on your pronunciation. It's like having a personal trainer for your accent. It's convenient. There is super flexible learning anytime, anywhere. Learn on the go with a mobile app or on your desktop at your schedule. There is amazing value because you have lifetime membership for all 25 languages for any and all trips and languages that you need in life. That is a steal. That is 25 language courses from Rosetta Stone that they offer it for 50% off. So don't put off learning that language. There is no better time than right now to get started. Shit No One Tells You About Writing listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. So go visit rosettastone.com/today. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/today today.
Fantasy writers, I hope you'll be joining me for the All About Fantasy full day virtual retreat on the 28th of September from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. Eastern Time. Whether you write YA fantasy, romantasy, adult fantasy, epic fantasy, cozy fantasy, dystopian fiction, or any other variation of the genre, you won't want to miss out on this amazing day of learning dedicated especially to you and those writing in your genre. The lineup includes award-winning and best-selling authors, as well as literary agents and editors who specialize in the genre. You'll have an opportunity to submit your query letter for critique. The Story Engine, who is sponsoring the retreat, is also hosting an awesome giveaway of an all things fantasy storytelling package that contains a copy of each of their decks, Story Engine deck and deck of worlds, each with their associated fantasy expansions, the mythology, dystopian, and fairy tale boosters, valued at $237. All delegates will also receive discounts when shopping on the Story Engine website. Come and learn, ask questions, and even more importantly, build community. To find out more and to register, go to my website, biancamaray.com, and look for the All About Fantasy tab. I hope to see you there.
Welcome, everyone, to a very special interview. This is Cece, and I have with me one of my all-time favorite authors, the author who wrote the book that became my obsession. You all know this. You already know who I'm talking about. I went on Instagram. I was ranting about how much I loved her debut. I've been like borderline harassing her to write more books faster because I'm completely obsessed. And it's quite embarrassing for me. But as luck would have it, I don't mind being embarrassed. So welcome, Parini Shroff. I will let you introduce yourself lest I fumble even that.
Thank you so much, Cece. It is such a pleasure to be here. I've been on chatting with you online, and you've been such a champion for me in my debut novel, The Bandit Queens, that this is such a treat to be able to get to interact with you live and face-to-face in a digital way. My name is Parini Shroff. I am a practicing attorney in the Bay Area in California. I practice law part-time, and I write fiction the other half of the time. My debut novel, The Bandit Queens, was longlisted for the Women's Prize, and I'm currently working on another novel.
There you have it, listeners. It is the author of The Bandit Queens, my complete obsession. If you follow me on social media, you know this. If you listen to the podcast, you know this. You know I'm obsessed. And apparently, Parini, you have extra time on your hands. Do you bend time? What is your secret? How do you do both? How do you practice law? And I know you said it's part-time, but come on, it's still a huge cerebral commitment. And write. How do you divide up your time?
You know, I actually think it's not as conflicting or as taxing as it might sound. Like, I think my CV sounds a bit more impressive than the day-to-day because it's different sides of my brain, I think. I get exhausted writing 8 hours a day. I get exhausted writing 3 hours a day, honestly. And to have that shift in my schedule, in my mental space, actually allows me to keep going. Like, it's improved my endurance because it's different. It's different critical thinking. It's a different beast. And getting to do both, I think, makes me more productive, as opposed to when I get a long stretch of time. I've been fortunate enough to do residencies, and having writing be my only job is such a boon, but it's also, I wasn't able to sustain it. So I think it's actually more complementary than it might initially appear.
That is a very interesting way to look at. So you mentioned it wasn't sustainable. Why was that?
I get fatigued with the voices in my head because they're very loud. I mean, when I wrote The Bandit Queens, so much of the process was dialogue heavy, and the prose and the interiority of the characters came after. And that is different than my process beforehand. And I should say The Bandit Queens is my debut and I'm very grateful, but it is not the first manuscript I've written. And I have been accustomed to rejection, as many artists are. So, right, I am very thankful to have this work out in the world and in your hands. But going back to what I was saying, when I was drafting The Bandit Queens, it was so dialogue heavy because the voices in my head would not quiet. They wouldn't shut up. And I would be writing dialogue at a rapid pace to the point where I had to forego quotations. I had to forego speech tags. I just knew who they were. And I was letting these characters riff, especially Geeta and Saloni, who are estranged best friends. And their banter is particularly acerbic and very loud in my mind. So living with those characters 8 hours a day, it was a bit much. So I tapped out around 3 or 4 hours and that give myself kind of a reprieve from that world and these characters of a very sassy woman.
And so you mentioned that it was dialogue heavy at first. Did you add prose? What's your process? Like, do you have a draft where it's like all dialogue essentially, and then you add narration and interiority and everything else? Or is it something different? Like, did I misunderstand? What's the situation there?
No, that's a great question. And to clarify, yes, so many of these chapters would be solely dialogue at the first pass, if you will. And then, you know, writing is rewriting. We will breathe it, know it, heard that version forever. And so I'd reread generally what I wrote the day before. That's how I'll start my writing day. I'll reread what I wrote before as a way to kind of warm up and trick myself into continuing. And when that editing happened, I would think about blocking. Where are these characters? And, you know, you always want to identify senses. What are they smelling? What are they seeing? What are they touching? Tasting, if that's relevant. And me addressing the sensory, blocking, where are they? And what are they feeling as they're saying, you know, quips or insults or what have you? That became a way to fill in the world. So it's not just, you know, floating dialogue. It's all right, we're grounding the reader in a specific setting.
I have to say that I'm like very surprised that you start with dialogue. I don't know why I'm surprised. I'm trying to unpack this emotion as I'm experiencing it, but like the dialogue in your story is amazing. Everything in your story is amazing. I have zero notes in terms of how this could be better. Obviously, it's a masterpiece, but the strongest part is the prose, like the best part of all. Like you have these amazing lines. Like I kept highlighting so many things. Things like a gram of prevention was worth a kilogram of revenge. Things like a childless woman was unfortunate. A happily childless woman was unnatural. Things like cradling an ego, she told herself, was as useless as throwing water into the sea. Like I will show you like these because I read on my iPad. These are all my highlights for your book. Like it's exhausting. Our listeners can't see this. Sorry, listeners. I'm essentially like showing Perini my ebook of the Bandit Queens. I have a print copy as well. I have an audio copy. When I obsess with the book, I properly obsess. But it's just so good. So I guess my question is, first, why do you think that's your process? Is it because of the voices? Is it something else? And what do you struggle with? Do you struggle with anything when you're writing, at least with the Bandit Queens? And I know you mentioned you had previous manuscripts before, so it could also be from those manuscripts.
I think that each project is different. And for the Bandit Queens, it was very dialogue heavy for me, at least initially. But that is not the case with, you know, former manuscripts of mine. It's been very prose and interiority and what are the characters conflicted with and by, and keeping a very close third person with my main protagonists. And so the Bandit Queens was an anomaly in that front. I mean, we'll see with future projects. But I think because The Bandit Queens was my first attempt at comedy, a dark comedy, the dialogue had to take priority because that's where a lot of the humor is. And once I realized that it was a dark comedy and I gave myself kind of a permission slip to write differently, which is, as we were just discussing, rapid fire dialogue, fill in the world later. That became just the process for that project. And I think because we change as people and as writers, it's important to not hold yourself to what served you before because it might not serve you now. And just giving yourself that, as I said, that permission slip, giving yourself a pass to grow and let each project be its kind of own thing will save you a lot of frustration with yourself and the work. And it'll also make it more fun. And the stories inside of us, they need to be told, but it's also a fun process and it's a fun job. And we got to try to enjoy that because so much of it is lonely and isolating and frustrating. So I think for me, I'm always trying to remind myself to find the joy in writing because that's why I do it. And I do absolutely struggle with portions of my writing. I'm terrible at endings. The Bandit Queens, the last two chapters took me as long as the rest of the novel to write. I think I wrote it during 2020 during the pandemic. So I think it took me, you know, 7 to 8 months to write The Bandit Queens and then another half year to write the last two chapters. I have 16 to 20 iterations of the last two chapters alone. And that was really frustrating. There was not a lot of joy at that time. I struggle with endings and I also struggle with describing nature. I don't know the names of anything, like trees, animals. I'm so terrible. So I mean, the internet is very helpful and my fiance is very helpful when I'm just like pointing at foliage. Like, what's that? What's that? Because you were talking about world building and I'm like, there is bush. I'm like, what? Or there is tree. Like, what kind of tree, Perini? And so I'm very like, my Google searches are bizarre because it's like ways to poison people. And what is this bush? And yeah, so I struggle with describing nature and endings.
That's so interesting. I don't want to ruin anything. I feel like most of our listeners, if you've not read The Bandit Queens, what are you doing? Also, I'm jealous because you get to read it for the first time, but go read it. But I do not want to spoil anything for anyone because we are lucky enough to have new listeners come to the show all the time. But the ending is fantastic and it felt so intentional, so cohesive, so tight. It felt like the things you included in the very first scene mirrored the ending in a perfect way. Like it all felt full circle and captivating. And I actually, in many of my classes, I use your book as an example of how to honor the web effect in storytelling. So the effect where everything feels connected and intentional, even though you can't see it from the beginning. You can only really see it at the end. But this is my way of saying you struggle with it, but you're good at it. In case you didn't know, I'm sure you know. I hope you know, but in case. So you mentioned point of view. We talk a lot about writing in first person, second person, third person, omniscient, whatever else. I have a very objective question for you, and then I'll clarify why I'm asking this question. What would you say is the point of view of the Bandit Queens?
No one's ever asked me that. That has taken me aback. I think the glib answer would be myself, like it's my point of view, as I inhabit various facets of my characters, or actually my character, into separate characters. But I think I say that because I don't think it's Geeta's, or solely Geeta's. Right.
Okay. Because I once had a very heated discussion with someone who also read your book and also loved it. And she was like, well, there was a point of view slip because it's supposed to be third person. But then towards the very end, and again, not going to ruin anything, something happens to Geeta. And there's a chapter in which the beginning is mirrored towards the very end. And it's through someone else's point of view. That's all I'm going to say, people. You obviously know what I'm talking about, Perini. And my whole discussion with her was no, it was never third person close. It was omniscient, focused on Geeta. And I have proof because there's a part in the book in which Geeta is thinking about, and I read this to her. I'm a big nerd, Perini. It's embarrassing. But like, there's a part in the book in which Geeta is just like thinking to herself about whether or not she wanted children. And it reads, and open parentheses, this might have been the magic of converting an impossibility into the illusion of choice, close parentheses. She wouldn't have done well with babies. Primarily because she just didn't like them very much. And she goes on and on about to say, you know, like, it's fine that she can't have kids because she wouldn't have wanted them anyway. But that parenthesis, that part where we read, it could have been, it might have been the magic of converting an impossibility, meaning the impossibility of having children, into the illusion of choice, meaning the illusion of this is what she would have chosen anyway. That to me is clearly omniscient because no one... Like that is like layers and layers and layers of the unconscious plus zooming out. So I was hoping you weren't going to tell me that I was right. But now I think that you just weren't burdened by what kind of point of view it was. It was very freeing, very liberating.
You are absolutely right. Now that I actually understand, you were talking about types and not a specific point of view. It absolutely is omniscient, mostly and close to Geeta. I think that that is how I always write, is omniscient, but close third. That is how I am just more comfortable in that. Usually past tense, but I'm dabbling with present tense and it is terrifying in a good way. That said, I always want to talk about that brief switch to another person's point of view before we click back and we're close with Geeta again. And nobody ever talks about it. So this is thrilling to me. That was intentional. And I had a conversation with my agent about it, who said, I normally don't like... This late in the game, I don't abide a shift, but something about this works. And I was delighted to hear it because, you know, you got to know the rules before you break them. And that was an intentional breakage because one character was kind of disappearing in a way. She was regressing. This might make sense to those of you who have read. Again, I want to be very careful and not give anything away. She's disappearing and is not herself, essentially. And that's why I had that shift to kind of show the ghost, this vibrant person kind of becoming more of a ghost and less of a main character in her own life. And that became the intention to do it briefly and then go back to what tone had been sustained throughout.
100%. And so for listeners, you are always asking us, well, how can I do that? How can I break the rules? Reading The Bandit Queens will show you how to do it. I so agree with your agent, Perini. Like, I am also someone who's like, no, no, no. As a rule, this doesn't work, because it doesn't work as a rule. As a rule, introducing a totally new point of view towards the very end of the novel doesn't work. Just like having a protagonist be passive doesn't work. And in many ways, Geeta has very little agency, especially in the beginning of the story. And then again, towards a midpoint, because something happens, and again, no spoilers, but passive protagonists are also typically boring, and Geeta is the opposite of boring. She's never boring, not even when the things happen and she does slip into a ghost. I guess I'm ruining the fact that it was Geeta who slipped into a ghost, but it is what it is. I think that also reading Perini's novel to our listeners will also really help with ensuring that your protagonist is active, even when their arc requires them be passive in some way. So that's also something I wanted to touch on. We always want to let our listeners know, like, in what way will this book help my writing? Because the best creative writing teacher in the world are books or other books. It's reading. And so we're really excited to do that. I wanted to go back to something you said. You said you are used to rejection. I don't know what your story is. Like, I don't know what your like path to publication looks like. Can you share?
Absolutely. I began writing when I was 6. I wrote a short story called The Magic Hole. It is framed behind me by my mother. It's terrible. And yet it started me on a journey where I wrote longer works. I wrote romantic fan fiction online, got to like engage with the community there. And then I changed my major from pre-med to creative writing without telling my parents. Then I got scared and I went to law school. Then I got courageous again and applied for my MFA. So then I moved to Austin, UT, where I got to study creative writing again and have it be, you know, my job to read and write, which is a blessing. And then after I graduated, I knew that I couldn't go back to working law full time because it would just be a disservice to like this choice that I made. So I was fortunate enough to find a part-time gig. And yes, it doesn't have the stability. Like, I'm not an employee. So, you know, health insurance and basically traditional guaranteed hours, all that are a bit up in the air. So there's not really that kind of safety, but it's a choice that really allows me to, you know, take a leave to go to writing residencies, which have been so helpful in my journey, and also to write part-time. So I was fortunate enough to find that kind of balance. And then this is, you know, 10 years ago, I graduated from UT 10 years ago. So since 2015 to present, I've been writing. I wrote 2 short story collections, 2 novel length manuscripts. And, you know, sometimes the agent says, oh, it's not ready. And sometimes you think you're ready and you go on submission and that doesn't happen. And so that's what I mean by there was some, you know, levels of rejection until ultimately I get to sit here and talk to you.
Well, I'm very grateful that it happened for you because my obsession would not exist otherwise. So it's something for which I'm very grateful. I want to talk about beginnings. The novel begins with women arguing, right? And right away, we understand that we're in Geeta's head and Geeta is an outsider. And the only reason why she belongs to this lone group is because they needed an extra body. And one of the women in this group is missing. And without her, they won't be able to give the money that they need to give to the loan officer. And, you know, they'll all be in default and it'll be a huge problem in their lives and et cetera, et cetera. So there's definitely like conflict right away. There's the outsider status of the protagonist right away. And at the same time, she is in a strange way, kind of an insider just for the day, since they're talking about someone else for once, as opposed to probably talking about her. Like, you have all these amazing curiosity inducing elements to your setup that really, really make for a perfect beginning because you're right in the action. And at the same time, you're able to zoom out and share important socio-emotional context about this protagonist, right? Like, it's not just this human in a room arguing with other women. I know that usually she doesn't get to hear gossip about someone else. I know that she is an outsider. I know that she needs the money. I know that they all judge her for not having kids. Like, I know all these things. So my long question is, did you always have this beginning? Do you struggle with beginnings? How do you crack the start of your stories, not just this one, but your other stories too? The founder of this podcast and my co-host and client, Bianca Murray, she compares starting a novel to circling a building. And like, yeah, sometimes the front door is the right way to go in, but sometimes you have to go through a window. Sometimes you have to like hang glide your way into the roof or whatever. So like, how do you do it? How do you start? Because so many of our listeners struggle with beginning a story.
I'm not the fairest person to ask just because The Bandit Queen started as a short story over a decade ago. And through that process of even crafting the short story when it was, you know, 13 pages, when it was 25 pages, much like the ending, that took 16, 20 drafts. And so by the time I put it in a drawer, I sure as hell needed to feel satisfied by it because it had taken so many iterations. So when I lifted it out of the drawer in the pandemic 2020, I reread it. And I felt like it was tight. And yet I had all these questions about what next? And that's, I think, my brain in those 10 years going from short story mode to novel mode. And that comes from reading, right? It comes from just seeing how the masters do it and taking what you learn and applying it to your own work. So I think distance helps with beginnings, because if you keep editing that first chapter or that intro without knowing where it'll take you, and this depends on if you outline or not, I do not. So I don't know where I'm going to head. And then you go back and you set it, make it seem like you knew what you're doing all along, have these little clues that later become moments of satisfaction for the reader, because if they're paying attention, they're like, oh, I see how that clicks. And that is so important for readers to feel satisfied, to make those connections and, you know, deduce. And that's why I love to read. I love to feel like I am the smartest person in this room because I got that. And so I think time and just keep going, because if you edit yourself before you write, you're going to be going around that building forever. So make it a bad draft. Make it crappy. You can edit a bad page. You can't edit an empty page.
I love that. I want to ask you about something. So, okay, to everyone who read the story, Geeta's pinky finger was broken. I'm not going to say by who, but this is something that, like, at the start of the story, this has already happened. And because of that, it can extend longer than her other pinky finger, or, you know, than she would have otherwise been able to. This ends up being the small detail that we learn about early in the novel ends up being instrumental to a scene later on in which that offers her salvation. That's all I will say. Everyone, you must read this novel. Did you go back? What you did with the pinky figure was add a clue, a curiosity seed, right? Like, it's something that later on, it all makes sense. Did you do that intentionally? Like, are you just brilliant? Can you just do these things without thinking about it? Or do you go back and do you include these clues to then have the payoff?
Both. But I will say that when I'm in a generative phase, I throw so much sand in the box. Some of the little revelations or little seemingly minor details that I want to come back in a big way, they never make it because it just doesn't work out. So what I do in the generative phase is I think of everything, inside jokes, if a character has a certain quirk of speaking that might later reveal their identity or something like that, you just, like, the mystery aspect of my brain goes, I'll throw everything into the box. And then later is sandcastle time where I'm like carving out, what are the parts of a sandcastle? See, this is, yeah, describing things, maybe not my forte right now, but carving out something from the sand that you dumped in. And so I think I do put it all up front, but picking and deleting what doesn't work, that's when the editing and the revising phase comes for me. So I don't often go back, but I have to cut a lot.
It's so interesting. I think you're the first person I've heard that does it that way. And it's really smart because it means you have tons of options to choose from. And whatever else you were later on able to include to make it be like a payoff, great, you can keep. But then the other stuff you can delete. I love that. Dark humor. Dark humor is one of my favorite things. As an agent, I want it all the time. Anyone listening, please send me dark humor. I'm desperate for more of that on my list. Does it come natural to you? Is it something that you've always infused into your work? Or because I remember you saying that you discovered that this was a dark comedy. So, like, what was that like?
My work before The Bandit Queens has not been comical, darker, or otherwise. It's been very not cheeky and set in India, about women, about injustice, about men too, about history, India's history, but not comical. And when I was writing The Bandit Queens, because the short story version wasn't funny either, I mean, this is my past work, it wasn't until I revisited it with the idea that it could be a longer work that the dialogue I spoke to you about earlier kept popping up. The minute I realized Geeta and Sloane disliked each other because they actually loved and knew each other, then the dialogue train took off. And that's when I realized, oh, these women are funny. They're not particularly well off. They have a lot of afflictions. They have a lot of duties and restrictions and lack of agency and the patriarchy stepping on their neck, but they're funny. And that's something that cannot be quashed. Then I realized that. And at first I fought it, which is why I had the advice of, like, let yourself be what your process is for each project. I fought it and I was editing before I was writing. And I thought, this is irreverent. You can't do this. nobody already wants your work. Why are you going to be weirder now? And then I said, what else are you going to do? There's a lot down. Your previous manuscript, you know, unfortunately didn't get purchased. What else are you going to do? Like, go with it. And when I gave myself that permission slip and let it be what it wanted it to be instead of what I thought it should be, the comedy just, it felt like, oh, I've always been funny. And now I can be funny on the page too.
I love that so much. Thank you so much for giving yourself permission to be funny. What's something, now that you're a published author, right? Like, I want you to go back in your mind to pre-publication Perini, pre-deal Perini. Like, you do not have a deal. What's something about being a published author that has surprised you?
I have wanted this for so long, you know, since I was a kid. I've wanted this for so long that I think I erroneously pinned my happiness on it. If I could just get published, if I could just get out there, everything will fall into place. And it is a huge blessing. It is super cool, not gonna lie, to have your dream realized. But it isn't the answer to everything clicking in place. Like, the stuff that makes me so happy that is in my life right now are the people and my dog. And those are what I found along the way to this goal, right? To this like hill, to finally kind of snatch that trophy. And it is a dream realized and it's incredible, but it's, we do this with so many of our achievements. If I could just get this raise and I could just get this promotion, if I could just do this, then I'll be sorted. And it's not the case, because there's always something else. If you are fortunate enough to have your dream realized and get a book, there's going to be the sophomore book struggle too. And that anxiety of like sharing parts of yourself and putting it out in the world for people to judge and consume and critique, that's never going to go away, especially if this is what you want as a career. You want to be, you want to establish yourself as an author. That's always, I think, going to be the case. And so I would tell myself, you can get it. It's going to be great, but it's not everything. And for so long, I made it everything.
Yeah. I mean, it's such a tough, fiercely competitive industry. And it's so hard to get it that it can be easy in the sense of like, you don't even think about it. Because you know how hard it is, you can be like, okay, but if I do it, then everything else will be easy, because that's the hard part. Anyway, I'm probably not making sense. But you've mentioned what you're working on next. May we ask, what can we know? How much can you share? When will I have my next obsession?
You know, when you get published, part of the ramp up is you and your brilliant publicist will have a chat about how to talk about your book, because I sure as hell did not know how to talk about the Bandit Queens. I would like scare people at cocktail parties. And so I'm on the kind of the back foot right now, because I don't have the benefit of a publicist telling me what my next book is about. But what I can share is that it follows a happily married couple. They've been together for a while, but they're happy because they wanted to write about not murdering husbands. They're a happy couple who lives in a city, so not a rural setting, but a city in modern day India. And through a series of bizarre misunderstandings, they inadvertently stumble upon a child trafficking ring.
I am very curious now. Okay, you must let me know as soon as it's available.
I absolutely will. I will. And I hope, you know, every time is different, as we just talked about. And so I hope this is something that also gets to be alive in the world. That would be wonderful.
So recommend a book. That's always the last question I ask of everyone. It can be a book that you read and you loved. It can be a book that you have not read yet, but you're excited to read, or anything else. But this is your opportunity to pay it forward and plug in a book.
All right. I loved Real Americans by Rachel Kong, and I loved her debut, Goodbye Vitamin 2. I recently read My Mother Cursed My Name at your suggestion, and I loved it. It's not yet available, but keep it, like pre-order it, do the things. And I will say, if you can be patient, also do the same for a novel called The Slip by Lucas Schaefer. I just read a galley and I'm so excited. Like, if you love comedy, you love sharp dialogue and just funny prose, Lucas Schaefer's The Slip, I sense big things. So if you can be patient or pin it or whatnot, I recommend. I recommend all these books.
Amazing. I have just finished Real Americans. Like, and I am obsessed. Like, that was an epic of a book. Like, it's so good. Yeah. Anyway, so now I'm going to add this left to my TBR. Thank you so much. Thank you so much, Perini, for joining us. This was so wonderful. I really appreciate it.
Oh, it's always such a pleasure. I'm delighted to be able to smile at your lovely face and say thank you again for having me and for being such an advocate of the book.
Everyone go read The Bandit Queens by Perini Schroff. If you don't love it, DM me and I will recommend that you go to a doctor because it clearly means that you will have hit your head against a very, very hard wall. Seriously, it's true. It's amazing. Okay, everyone, bye. See you next week.
A reminder that this is an unscripted program and our conversations have been edited and condensed and is not a full picture of our feedback or conversation directly with each author. As always, refer back to our written notes for the fulsome picture. Carly Waters and Cece Lira are agents at PS Litera Agency, but their work on this podcast is not affiliated with the agency, and the views expressed by Carly and Cece on this podcast are solely that of them as podcast co-hosts and do not necessarily reflect the views, opinions, policies, or position of PS Litera Agency. A reminder about all the ways that you can support us as a show: rate us 5 stars on Apple Podcasts, tell your writing friends about us. We'd love to help as many writers as possible. And follow us on our Substack newsletter. Get our stacked newsletter on a weekly basis, bonus videos, articles, essays, advice, and more. You can find it at theshitaboutwriting.substack.com. That's theshitaboutwriting.substack.com.
And that's it for today's episode. I hope you'll join us for next week's show. In the meantime, keep at it. Remember, it just takes one yes.
The best thing about writing? Anything can happen. You get to build a world from scratch and fill it with daring heroes and epic tales of good and evil. The worst thing about writing? Anything can happen. Where do you even start when literally anything is possible? How about a deck with more than 30 billion writing or world-building prompts? The Story Engine deck and Deck of Worlds are a great way to fire up your imagination. Create a new character with fun quirks and daring motivations in less than 60 seconds with the Story Engine. With Deck of Worlds, build entire civilizations with distinct foods, customs, and history, and set the plot in motion with world-shaking conflicts for your characters to overcome. It's time to write your next bestseller. Our decks give you the tools to tell the story you want to tell. Visit StoryEngineDeck.com and use promo code AboutWriting10 at checkout to get 10% off your entire order from now until September 30th. That's AboutWriting10. Slay your writer's block and get excited to sit down at your desk every day. Go to StoryEngineDeck.com and pick up the Story Engine Deck and Deck of Worlds.